It became clear immediately that Brown had become the most important person not only among the nanoinformatics group, or even research in general, but in the entire room. Over the following days, Fong, who had never treated anyone in research as better than suspicious, deferred to him when the guards brought food. Drexler sat near him before lights out, laughing at anything he said that might pass for a joke. When Sujai and Ma fell into one of their singing mock competitions, they invited Brown in, though he demurred. Speculation ran in all directions. We would be extradited and tried for the dead Martians on Phoebe. The company had found diplomatic channels to negotiate for our release. The Outer Planets Alliance and the Martian Republic were at war, and our fates were going to be part of the settlement. My own theory, the only one that really made sense to me, was that the experiment had been running all this time, and something new had happened. Grave or miraculous, it carried a weight of importance and inscrutability that brought us back from our forgotten place in a Belter prison and into the light. The Martian had come because he needed the things that only we knew, and possibly needed it badly enough to overlook our previous sins. In the observation windows above us, guards appeared more often now, usually with their attention fixed on Brown. It was not only the prisoners who found his new status of interest. Brown himself changed, but not in the way others might have. While I believe he made use of the opportunities his new status afforded him, he did so rationally. He didn't hold himself more grandly, did not deepen the timbre of his voice. He did not hold court or bask in the new attention given to him. Humanity is social, and the self-image of humans is built from the versions of ourselves we see and hear reflected in others. That this is not true of the research group, of Coombs or Brown or Quintana or me, was, after all, precisely the point. Instead, Brown balanced his new power with the new risks it carried. He made an unofficial alliance with Fong, staying near her and her people so that should Quintana or I try to take the hand terminal by force, there were others who could interfere in an attempt to curry favor with him. Van Ark responded by eating and sleeping closer to Quintana and Alberto and myself. He'd had no love of Brown, and treated his elevation as an insult. The room was pulling itself apart, like a cell preparing to divide. Brown and the Martian's hand terminal formed one locus, Quintana and I, the other. We planned our theft quietly. When Brown sat bent over the terminal, he could not watch us talk, but Quintana and I were discreet all the same. I squatted at the side of a crash couch while he lay in it, facing away from me. The metal and ceramic made too hard a backrest, my spine aching where it pressed. I tried not to move my lips while we spoke. Fong, I felt sure, noticed us, but did nothing. Or perhaps she didn't see us. Fear kept me from looking around to find out. He has to sleep, Quintana said. He also has to wake up, I said, recalling Alberta's advice. Quintana shifted on the couch, the gimbals hissing as the cup of the couch readjusted. Across the room, Brown sat near the hotel. The hand terminal flickered, throwing subtle shadows onto his cheeks and the hollows around his eyes. With the right equipment, I could have modeled his face, its reflectivity, and rebuilt the image he was looking at. I realized that Quintana had been speaking, and I didn't know what he'd said. When I asked him to repeat himself, he sighed with a sound very much like the gimbals. Once I get it, you hide it, he said. They'll question me, search where I went. Then they'll have to give him another copy. Once that happens, we'll be safe. They won't care anymore. You can get it back out and give it to me. You won't even have to get in trouble. Won't they punish us? He'll have the copy. Why would anyone care about the original? I suspected that analysis had some holes in it, but I didn't object out of concern that Quintana would grow impatient and scrap the plan. I resolved instead to ask Alberto if he thought the stolen hand terminal would be trivial once a copy was delivered, but as things fell out, I didn't have the chance. Navarro, one of Fong's leadership from security, walked toward us. I coughed, alerting Quintana, and he changed to talking about the nutritional value of Belter food compared to the fare we'd had before the room, and the probable health effects that we could expect from our systematic malnutrition. Navarro sat at the next couch over, watching the guards at the window watch us. She didn't say anything. She didn't need to. The message, "You're being watched," was clear. That afternoon, the guards came early and took Brown away. They offered no explanation, simply found him there among us, nodded to the doors they'd entered through, and escorted him away. I watched him leave. My heart was in my throat, and I was certain it was already too late. If they were taking him to the Martian, he might never come back. When Brown returned to the room, just before nightfall, confusion and worry pressed on his brow, but he carried the hand terminal with him. That night, as we curled up to sleep, I told Alberto of my fear that Brown and the hand terminal might vanish before I could see what was on it.
"Better if it did," Alberto said, holding my hand.
I didn't know if he meant that with the irritant of hope gone, the room could return to something like its resting state, or something more personal between the two of us. I intended then to sound him out about Quintana's plan, but he had other intentions that were more urgent and immediate, and when we were spent, I curled in his arms, warm and content in the way that being a masculine animal allows. Either Brown's temporary absence spurred Quintana to action sooner than planned, or he had told me his timetable when my attention was elsewhere. The first I knew that action had been taken was the screaming, then pelting footfalls going one way and the next. I tried to stand, but Alberto impeded me, and then from the darkness, a dim glow. The plate of a hand terminal moving toward me. Quintana loomed up out of the darkness, pressing hard ceramic into my hand. He didn't speak, but ran on past me. I curled back with Alberto and waited. Brown was shrieking now, his voice banshee-ing up until it threatened to rise above the wavelengths of human perception. And then Fong. And then Quintana proudly announcing that Brown didn't deserve the data, couldn't understand the data, and was going to doom us all to living and dying in the room out of his own misplaced pride. I lay with my head against my lover's shoulder, the hand terminal tucked beneath our bodies, while the other prisoners screamed and fought in the darkness, the first open combat in the war Alberto had foreseen. The Belter guards did not come. I felt sure their absence meant something, but I couldn't say what. I didn't want to leave the relative safety and warmth of the crash couch, but I knew that the battle raging in the darkness was also my best cover. Quintana's belief that I wouldn't be questioned because he had taken the credit for stealing the terminal seemed optimistic to me. Worse, it seemed like the kind of asserted reality, the willful decision to believe that people would act the way you preferred that they would, that posed a constant threat to those of us in research. I slid the terminal down the front of my already open jumpsuit and moved to rise from the couch, hoping the sound of the gimbals would be lost under the shouting. Alberto took my hand for the space of a breath, and then released it.
"Be careful," he whispered.
As I moved through that darkness, the room felt even bigger than it was. I had the most precious thing in my life pressed against the skin of my belly, while men and women whose voices I knew intimately, the compatriots of my years-long captivity, threatened and defied and wheedled and cried out in sudden pain. Like a stage magician's arcing gesture, they commanded the attention and gave me the cover to do what needed to be done. I slid the hand terminal under one of the crash couches that defined the hotel, stepped back to see that no light was escaping from its dim display, and then trotted back to Alberto through the darkness, afraid to be caught away from my customary place. The sudden, harsh light of morning found Quintana sitting with his back against a wall,
eyes blackened and swollen closed, nose and lips bloodied, and Fong organizing a search. I was among her first targets, and Alberto shortly after me. Brown opened a new round of shouts and accusations, and Fong had to set two of her people to prevent him from assaulting Quintana further. It occurred to me that Brown was making Quintana's argument more effectively than Quintana had. The sense of Brown's status as our savior and best hope of freedom tarnished quickly in the next hours. I felt the confidence the others had in him faltering, like the pressure of a coming storm. If they turned on him, unleashed the years of frustration and anxiety and despair upon his fragile human body, I didn't think the guards would be able to reach him in time. It was an interesting possibility, but also a warning, should I manage to put myself in his place. As soon as it seemed plausible, I took Alberto by the hand and drew him toward the hotel. Hardburger and Navarro were going through the crash couches near it, and I was anxious that they would find our golden apple before I had a chance to taste it. I thought Navarro scowled at me as I made my way toward privacy and the hiding place, but it might only have been my imagination. Once we were in the hotel and visually cut off, I retrieved the hand terminal. Now, with light and proximity, I could actually see it. Blue-gray casing with an extended keyboard for full scientific notations. A scratch along the right side of the screen that caught and refracted the light of the display. Rainbows out of the yellow default image. A logo of the Mars Congressional Republic Navy stamped into the casing and echoed on the screen. I stroked it with my fingertips, feeling serene and untouchable. If church had felt half as good as this, I would have been a religious man. With a sense of nearly superhuman calm, I opened the data files. Charts and reading appeared before me. It was the experiment. My experiment. Only it also was not. The basic structures were there. The peculiar way the individual molecular engines unfolded. The instantaneous networking that suggested entanglement communication. The beautifully complicated tertiary beta sheeting, studded with proteins, dense with information and vulnerable to oxidation. I had the sudden, powerful memory of being in the lab on Phoebe, seeing the nanoparticles express those sheets for the first time. Krantz had described it as snowflake castles, looking for the nearest blowtorch. They were still beautiful, still fragile, but they had defied the blowtorch. They had found ways to express themselves. Creating what appeared to be massive constructions implied first in their microscopic structure, like an infinite cascade of fractal design. There were maps of control points that were clearly cellular machinery that had been hijacked and modified. Complex layers of pattern-matching mechanisms that stank of human neocortical structures. And something else. I was looking at the oak and recognizing the acorn. I spooled through the information as quickly as I could, taking in the first and last paragraphs of the reports, glancing at the diagrams and data just long enough to take a general sense of them, and then moving on. The navigation keys of the hand terminal clicked as I pressed them, like I was crushing tiny beetles. There was clearly a deeper structure that the development of the beta sheets was protecting and promoting. I didn't begin to understand the energetic dynamics of it. But there was, I thought, a privileged group. Something about the logic of the individual particles reminded me of a paper I'd read in Tel Aviv that re-examined sperm. The thesis was that rather than a homogeneous collection of equally competing cells, there were classes of sperm. Subspecies that acted as a team to present a chosen cell or class of cells to the ovum. Alberto said my name, and I was aware of it the way I might have been aware of a candle flame in the noonday sun. It was there, but it had very little impact. The privileged group could probably be identified by its place within the logical structure of the network, but something about that felt wrong. I paged back through the diagrams. I had the sense There was an asymmetry in the network someplace that I could almost, not quite, but almost place. It was analogous to something I already knew about, but I didn't know what. I growled and went back to the start. Alberto said my name again, and I looked up too late. Fong stood over us, her expression carved from hardwood. I felt a flash of resentment at her interruption and swallowed it quickly. I held out the hand terminal. "Look what I found," I said. She took it from me and paused. I could see the desire to punish me in her mouth and the angle of her shoulders. Alberto squirmed beside me and Navarro appeared at Fong's side. I heard Brown yawp with delight. He'd caught sight of his lost treasure. I anticipated Quintana's anger and disappointment, but it didn't matter to me. My goal had never been to help him. "Quintana's an asshole, but he isn't wrong. He won't solve it," I said. And Fong shook her head as if to say, "I don't know what you're talking about." I smiled tightly. "Brown won't solve it. He won't give them what they're looking for. We may not get another chance." "That's not how this works," she said. "I can help," I said. "Tell him to let me help." For a moment, it seemed as if she might reply, but instead she turned away without pressing the issue. It felt like a victory.